Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy, Anna Mateo, and Dan Friedel. Later, Katie Weaver and Ashley Thompson have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report.
Now, more than ever, higher education is one of the most important tools many people have as they seek a bright economic future. The Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce studies the relationship between education and employment. In 2014, the center released a report on the future of the United States job market. It found that by the year 2020, 65% of all U.S. jobs will require workers to have some kind of education or training after they finish high school. But the Department of Education reports that younger Americans often have difficulty meeting that requirement. It reported that in 2015, only about 42% of people between 18 and 24 years of age were in a post-secondary degree study program. Also, only about 60% of college students who started a four-year degree program in 2008 completed its requirements within 6 years. So, how might the United States better educate its population? Some experts believe community college is the answer.
Community colleges have long been the way for Americans facing economic or other barriers to get a college education. In 1947, the U.S. government called on states to each create their own system of public, two-year institutions to serve communities in need. These schools offer classes costing less than other colleges or universities, and they often have no academic requirements for students who attend. Mike Krause is the executive director of the Tennessee Higher Education Commission. His group supports the expansion of higher education across the state. Krause says that many Tennesseans see any college program as something that is not doable for them. Talk Poverty, a research group, reports that about 16% of Tennessee's population lives below the poverty line, the amount of money needed to pay for life's necessities. Krause argues that with college costs reaching record levels, many people have seen low-skilled jobs in fields like manufacturing as their best path forward.
Krause notes that many American businesses have taken their manufacturing jobs to other countries where workers are paid less. Also, machines have replaced human laborers in some positions. So people still working in manufacturing must possess more high-level training. A working knowledge of technology is helpful now in many jobs that may not have required a four-year college degree in the past. Krause says these changes in the American labor market began to worry Tennessee's leadership. So in 2014, they created the Tennessee Promise Program. It provides recent high school graduates 2 years of free classes at any of the state's community or technical colleges. The goal is to make sure 55% of Tennesseans have earned some form of post-secondary certification by 2025. And earlier this year, the state began offering free community college to older adults as well to help reach this goal. Two other states, Rhode Island and Oregon, have also started offering free community college to their citizens. And a growing number of other experts say community college could be the next best way to make more Americans competitive in the modern workforce.
Jeff Stroll is the director of research at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He says during the economic recession 10 years ago, many people began to question the value of a traditional four-year degree. Families were paying more and more money for their children's education. But many recent graduates found there were fewer jobs available, especially ones that would pay well enough to cover the costs of student debt. Economic conditions across the country have improved in recent years. But Stroll says the return on investment has never been equal for four-year degrees from every field. An engineering student, for example, will likely make far more money than a student with a degree in social work. And Stroll says many employers have raised the issue that many four-year degree holders still lack necessary skills to join the workforce. Their degrees do not show exactly what they can do. Community colleges, on the other hand, have a history of teaching specific skills or technical training to students for a specific job, he says.
In July, the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce released another report on the job market. It defined a good job as one that paid, on average, $55,000 a year. The report found that since 1991, the United States had lost about 2.8 million good jobs that did not require a four-year degree, especially in manufacturing. However, the number of skilled service jobs, which only require the kind of two-year degree one can get at community college, increased by about 4 million. These jobs are in fields like healthcare, education, and financial services. And with a two-year degree or other certification, a person can enter these fields with the training necessary to start working immediately. Stroll notes that a four-year degree program is still the best way for students to improve their lives in the long term. But for people who are unable to spend the time and money necessary to earn one, this is a different source for a high-quality education. Also, many young people start their higher education at a community college only to move on to a traditional college once they are ready to do so.
In addition, labor lawyer Mark Hudson suggests major changes may be coming to the world of higher education. He says that as more people choose less traditional paths to education, the way schools offer their programs may change.
Do you need a four-year degree to be a computer coder? I think there's a real interesting question there, and that's why you're seeing a lot of the code schools pop up that are 14 weeks. If you do that in 14 weeks, do you need to go for 4 years? You might not need to.
I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now it's time for Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explain the meaning and usage of common expressions in American English. Today, we will talk about expressions with the word heel. Now, heel has several meanings, many of which relate to the end or back of things. For example, we call the two ends of a loaf of bread the heels. This can be good to know, especially if you like dipping a bread heel into a simmering pot of tomato sauce or soup. Another meaning of heel is the end of your foot. In an earlier Words and Their Stories, we explained the story of Achilles' heel in detail. So we won't repeat that expression in this program. Why should we when there are so many others to choose from? Just as the heel is the back of your foot, the heel of your shoe is also the back part. Many women like to wear high-heeled shoes. They may look nice, but high heels can cause pain and are not good for your feet. Sometimes we call the really high-heeled shoes that women wear killer heels. Speaking of shoes, wealthy people usually have many. To be well-heeled means to be wealthy and well-to-do. Perhaps wearing nice shoes is where well-heeled comes from. Let's move from shoes to pets. You may hear dog owners who are training their dogs say something like, "Heel boy, heel." Here, the verb heel means to follow or stop at a person's heels. Now, you would not leave your beloved pet with a heel. This is a person you cannot trust. Heel used in this way comes from an early 20th century American expression meaning an incompetent or worthless criminal. Language experts say this definition may come from a person in the lowest position being compared to the heel of the foot. Let's talk more about this body part. Have you ever wanted to describe a situation where you were unwilling to change your mind about something? You could say you dug your heels in. Someone digging their heels in the ground would be difficult to move. Stubborn is a good word to describe people who have dug their heels in. You could even use them together. For example, I stubbornly dug my heels in when my friend suggested we go to the mountains instead of the seashore. I really wanted to go to the beach. If someone or something is at your heels, they are following closely behind you. Let's say you have a little brother who really wants to hang around you all the time. He is always at your heels, which could become annoying. However, being on the heels of something is a little different. This expression means that something happens soon after something else. For example, Sonia and Timothy announced their plans to get married on the heels of another big announcement, Sonia's divorce from her last husband. Good timing, Sonia. As a body part, our heels find themselves in two other common expressions. To kick up your heels means to have fun. Some word experts think this expression may have come from the world of horses. Others say it comes from the way you might use your feet when you are waiting for something. Regardless of its origin, Americans often use this expression after they have been very busy, as in this example. After studying all month, the students were happy to finish their exams, kick up their heels, and relax. The saying, to cool your heels, means you are forced to wait for something to happen. For example, you may have to cool your heels at a doctor's office or in a long line at the store. We often use this expression as a command. If your friend really wants to go to a party, but you need to make a quick stop first, you could say, "Hey, cool your heels, the party will still be there." To cool your heels is also casual. If I were talking in a more serious and official situation, I might say that I waited patiently. This expression dates back to the 16th century. After horses ran a long race, their feet were hot. So the animals stood in water to cool their feet. By the next century, people were using the saying, cooling his heels, to describe someone who was in a hurry but had to wait for something. And that's all for this Words and Their Stories. We will be back next week. Until then, you'll just have to cool your heels. I'm Ana Mateo.
Russia has unveiled a monument to Mikhail Kalashnikov, creator of one of the most famous firearms in the world. The 7.5-meter-tall statue features Kalashnikov holding his famous rifle. Mikhail Kalashnikov was born in a rural area of Russia in 1919. As a boy, Mikhail was interested in making farm equipment. He was born into a farming family, after all. But later, he became a soldier and was injured in World War II. Kalashnikov and some other soldiers decided that the Russian army needed better rifles than those used by the Germans. So Kalashnikov started designing his own. His first weapons were not very good, but in 1947, he designed the weapon that came to be known as the AK-47. It got its name because it was an automatic rifle designed in 1947. An automatic rifle does not have to be loaded by hand after each shot. The weapon gained in popularity because it worked equally well in hot, wet jungles and cold, dry mountains. It was also easy to operate and take care of. Some users can take an AK-47 apart in just 30 seconds. Russia sent the guns to its allies and sold the design to other countries so they could produce their own versions. Some experts think 70 million Kalashnikov rifles have been made. They say the AK-47 and its more modern versions represent 20% of the world's firearms. Both Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Minister of Culture see the AK-47 as important to the identity of Russia. Putin said, "The Kalashnikov rifle is a symbol of the creative genius of our people." While Russian leaders celebrated Kalashnikov's memory with the statue, some activists demonstrated at the event. The protesters said a person who created an instrument of death should not be considered a hero. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, reported one protester calling the statue loathsome and trash. I'm Dan Friedel.
This week on our national parks journey, we head to the southeastern state of Kentucky. Here you will find rolling hills and thick green forests. But beneath the land is a strange and silent underground world. One early explorer described it as grand, gloomy, and peculiar. Welcome to Mammoth Cave National Park.
Mammoth Cave is the longest known cave system in the world. It is 2 times as large as the world's second biggest cave system. Its size helped give it its name. Mammoth, as an adjective, means extremely large. Mammoth Cave National Park is in Kentucky's Green River Valley. The park covers over 20,000 hectares. It protects the river valley and hilly land, as well as the vast underground cave system. The U.S. Congress formed Mammoth Cave National Park in 1941. 40 years later, it was named a World Heritage Site. And in 1990, it became a UNESCO Biosphere Reserve Site. Researchers and explorers have mapped more than 600 kilometers of passageways in Mammoth Cave, and scientists continue to explore it.
Water formed the cave over millions of years. Other than the Green River, few sources of water exist above ground. That is because water seeps quickly into the earth. Soil made of broken down limestone absorbs the water. This has created a vast and complex system of chambers and passageways. A delicate and unique ecosystem exists inside the cave. More than 100 kinds of animals live in Mammoth Cave. Some of them live their whole lives in total darkness. Cave shrimp and many other kinds of eyeless, colorless species can be found. Mammoth Cave was once home to about 10 million bats. They included species like Indiana bats, big brown bats, little brown bats, and the eastern small-footed bat. Now they number in the thousands.
Humans first entered Mammoth Cave about 4,000 years ago. They discovered uses for minerals inside the cave. Researchers describe them as primitive miners. Humans explored Mammoth Cave for nearly 2,000 years. Then their exploration appears to have ended. The caves would not be explored again until the end of the 1700s. Many stories name John Houchins for rediscovering the cave. They say he was hunting in the area when he came upon a black bear. The bear was close to the entrance of the cave. Houchins shot the bear, but he failed to kill it. The bear ran, and Houchins followed. It led him into the cave. Experts do not agree on the exact year of Houchins' discovery, and some people question the story entirely. Slaves played played many important roles at Mammoth Cave during the 1800s. During the War of 1812, slaves mined the cave for a mineral called saltpeter. It was used to produce ammunition used during battle. And in 1816, slaves began guiding visitors on cave tours. At the time, the cave was still privately owned.
One of the greatest early explorers of the cave was a slave named Stephen Bishop. He arrived at Mammoth Cave in 1838 when he was a teenager. He learned the tour paths from white guides. But Bishop wanted to push beyond the cave's toured areas. He set off to explore parts of the cave no human had ever seen. Bishop and a companion sought to cross an area called the Bottomless Pit. Its unknown darkness had stopped people from trying to go beyond it. But fear and darkness did not stop Bishop. The areas he discovered beyond Bottomless Pit are still open to visitors today. Bishop started naming different areas of the cave that he discovered: Fat Man's Misery, Cleveland Avenue, and Mammoth Dome, among others. He was also the first to discover a river running through the cave. Bishop created a map of Mammoth Cave in the early 1840s. It included 16 kilometers of passageways. Most of the passages had been discovered or explored by Bishop himself. His map remained in use for more than 40 years. Bishop gained his freedom in 1856, but he died the next year at the age of 37. His grave lies within Mammoth Cave National Park. It was Bishop who described Mammoth Cave as grand, gloomy, and peculiar.
For national park visitors who venture into the cave today, Bishop's description remains true. About 500,000 people tour the cave each year. They are among more than 2 million visitors to the park itself. Mammoth Cave National Park offers campsites for those who want to sleep under the stars. There is also a hotel in the park. And there are plenty of activities outside of the cave. People ride horses on the more than 100 kilometers of park trails. They also fish and boat in the park's rivers. But the main draw of Mammoth Cave National Park remains the dark mystery of an underground world with so much more to discover. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.